Wars of Islamic Succession.
Women in 7th century Arabia were certainly no shrinking violet. We even have the indelible image of Aisha in the Battle of the Camel, which she fought against Ali. She led 10,000 men into battle.
That's Leslie Hazelton talking about Aisha, the youngest wife of the Prophet Muhammad. She's one of the subjects of Hazelton's book, After the Prophet.
Partners in Health, they have 1.3 million patients. They have brought AIDS, tuberculosis, a host of other infectious diseases under control in the Central Plateau. You know, this was something that 10 years ago, a lot of experts were saying just wasn't ever going to happen, wasn't possible. And they do this with remarkable economy. And the reason they can do it with remarkable economy is that their people are doing it aren't Haitian.
And that's Tracy Kidder. We talked to him about Haiti, Dr. Paul Farmer, and the organization Farmer founded, Partners in Health. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, airing on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As the Prophet Muhammad lay on his deathbed in 632 AD, the plotting about who would succeed him swirled around his prostrate form. The wars of succession that ensued are still going on today in the split between Shia and Sunni. Yet Islam was a religion founded on an ideal of unity, unity that, my guest Leslie Hazelton says, was undermined by human folly. Her fascinating book, After the Prophet, chronicles the bloody history of this folly, the tensions, jealousies, and power plays that followed on the heels of Muhammad's death. Leslie Hazelton is a psychologist and journalist who writes about religion and politics in the Middle East. I asked her what went wrong after Muhammad died.
One could say that the beginning of the whole problem was that Muhammad died without sons. He had had three sons, all of whom died in infancy. So there was no natural successor, as it were. And the word for successor in Arabic is Khalifa, from which we get the English caliph. So who would be the first caliph? Who would lead Islam after he had died? And he had not made this clear. So there were some who maintained that his closest male relative, who was Ali, philosopher warrior who had married his daughter Fatima, that Ali was both the spiritual and the political successor to Muhammad. He was the one closest to him and most embodied his spiritual aspects. And there were others who said, no, it should be the person who's most, who gets the consensus of the whole community, that sacredness and authority, as it were, resided not in the Prophet's family and who was his closest blood relative, but in the community as a whole. That is, the whole community of Islam was sacred, not just the family of Muhammad. And this was the basic split that occurred. And Ali on one side, his followers were called the Shi'at Ali, the followers of Ali, and thus the word Shia. Whereas those who maintained that the community as a whole was sacred would come to be known as the Sunnis after the Sunnah, which is the practice of the Prophet.
Yes, and so now take us back a little bit. Tell us something about Muhammad himself, because it seems to me that some of these conflicts that developed really have their root in the kind of society that he came into and that he had to change in order to create Islam.
I think this is one thing we do not realize in the West, or non-Muslims in any case do not realize in the West, and that is how revolutionary a movement Islam was. Muhammad was basically an extraordinary revolutionary thinker. That is, his whole thinking challenged the status quo, the established power elite of Mecca. This was a society that had only been for a couple of hundred years that had been settled. But in that process of settling from nomadic desert life into what was by then a thriving, bustling trade center and also a big pilgrimage center, Mecca, had lost some of the principles of tribal life, which included basically looking after everybody in the community, a kind of egalitarianism that was essential for those living under very threatening conditions, on the edge, as it were, in the very, very difficult life of living in the desert. Once they came into town and people started to get rich, certain clans started to get very, very wealthy from the trade, that whole principle of looking after everybody was gone. So you had a message that was actually very similar to that of Jesus 600 years earlier, which was that the sacred was in everybody. Everybody had equal access to the sacred, to God, and that everybody had equal worth, no matter whether they were slave or owner, whether they were rich or poor, male or female. And all this is quite clearly laid out in the Quran. And it was an extraordinary message and a very threatening message, of course, to the power elite. So I think that really, early Islam and Muhammad's Islam, as he presented it, has to be seen as a kind of social and economic revolution.
Well, isn't there a kind of contradiction between the idea that then his successor would inherit the post, so to speak, in a kind of dynastic way, because he was a member of the family, versus the Sunni idea of a community?
There is and there isn't. It was a matter of who was closest to him, who most embodied the spiritual aspect as well as the political aspect. And it was particularly vivid, since at the moment he died, Islam was poised to surge out of Arabia into the whole of the Middle East. The irony here, the perfect timing of the beginning of Islam was that just as the two great empires to the north, and what we now think of as the main part of the Middle East, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and so on, the Byzantine Empire to the west and the Persian Empire to the east, which in the middle land between them, where they clashed most, of course, was, of all places, Iraq, had basically fought each other to a standstill, and we're just deteriorating. And just at the time that there was this vacuum of power in the heartland of the Middle East, here Muhammad had done the unthinkable. He had united the tribes of Arabia under one God for one people, a very distinct Arab, pan-Arab identity. And just as, you know, as that power vacuum was there to the north, they were getting organized, united. And therefore this surge north, which was not due to any kind of, I mean, it's been called, believe it or not, by people who should know better, leading academics, has been called a tribal imperative to conquest, which is a very, very strange term. It does not occur anywhere in the anthropological literature that I can find, in any case. And it makes no sense when you think about the organization of tribes. In fact, there's no need to posit such a thing. What happened was that even before Muhammad, the traders of Mecca were very well known throughout the Middle East. I mean, when you take a camel caravan, a trading caravan, 700-800 miles across the desert from Mecca, say, to Damascus, which was a huge center, huge trading center. First of all, we are not talking about 20, 30 camels. We're talking about 2,000, 3,000, even 4,000 camels at a time. These were huge ventures.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have something of that extent, which takes weeks and weeks to get there, you do not just do the equivalent of a touch-and-go at Damascus Airport, as it were. You settle in. To be a trader at that time was to be a voyager, and to be a voyager was to be a sojourner. You settled in. There was hospitality to be extended. There were negotiations to be made, and so on. So you became part and parcel of the society that you traded with. So, as I say, even before Muhammad, you would find Meccan traders owning farms in Palestine and date orchards in Iraq and huge estates around Damascus. And with them, of course, they spread their culture, the Arabic language, and, as it would come to be, you know, after Muhammad, Islam. And in return, they also absorbed the culture with which they were trading, which included both Judaism and Christianity.
Hmm. You know, I want to go back to something that you said before. You talked about the equality of women in Muhammad's mm-hmm. creed. And, of course, this might surprise many people, given the subjugated role of women in so many Islamic cultures.
Yes, indeed.
Tell us Well, first tell us about Aisha, who was his favorite wife. She certainly seemed to be a pretty liberated woman.
Well, that's putting it in 21st century terms. Women in 7th century Arabia were certainly no shrinking violet. They were very, very powerful forces. We even have the indelible image of Aisha in the Battle of the Camel, which she fought against Ali when he did finally become caliph, the fourth caliph. She led 10,000 men into battle against him. And when I say led, it's called the Battle of the Camel, after the red camel on which she sat inside her howdah, hurling these blood-curdling cries for greater feats of valor from her men and kill the enemy and show them, etc., etc., and conceded only, I mean, as her own men were being cut down literally at her feet, conceded even, she never really did concede. She knew she'd lost the battle, but she never actually quite conceded. An immensely strong character, not at all the image we have of the conservative image that we have nowadays of Muslim women. And there are many women in this period who played an equally strong role, in fact, not quite as strong as Aisha. Aisha is always outspoken, always up front. She was the first Muslim to ever hurl a shoe in protest at an earlier caliph whom she considered corrupt, in fact, probably was. She is always out there, and whether you like her or don't like her, and this will depend on whether you sympathize more with the Shia point of view or the Sunni point of view. The Shia dislike her immensely and maintain that, in fact, in After the Prophet, that I've been far too nice to her and kind to her and have romanticized her, whereas the Sunni venerate her far more and maintain that I have given far too harsh a picture of her and have even disrespected her, which leads me to believe that maybe, just maybe, I got it just right. Whether you like her or you don't like her, you cannot ignore her. And that, I think, is probably, for her, would be the greatest compliment.
And we're speaking with Leslie Hazelton. Her book is After the Prophet, the Epic Story of the Shia-Sunni Split in Islam. So now, Aisha, why did she hate Ali?
Oh, that is a wonderful story that goes back to something called the Affair of the Necklace. Aisha lost a necklace out in the desert. She would go on raids and ventures. There were basically campaigns that Muhammad undertook throughout Arabia, getting the tribes, various tribes, into the network of Islam to pledge allegiance and to accept Islam. Usually it was done by negotiation. At last resort, it was done by the sword. But she would go along, which for her, of course, was very exciting. She was basically this urban teenager who was just, you know, that's the way she saw the world. But in any case, on one of these campaigns, very close back to Mecca, she lost a necklace and lost it somewhere. You know, she'd gone out to perform her toilet in the behind a broom bush somewhere, and it apparently had snagged on a twig and all the beads had broken. And it was a necklace that Muhammad had given her, so it was particularly precious to her. So off she goes. Now, just as the whole camel train is getting ready to leave, off she goes back to find it without telling anybody. And by the time she finds it, and finds all the beads and comes back, everybody's left. And she's left alone in the desert. The strange thing with this story is that, you know, they can't have been that far ahead. They can only have been half an hour ahead. I mean, she was a teenager. She was young. She was strong. She didn't even need to run. She could have walked fast to catch up with them. But she was very aware of her status as, you know, the youngest and favorite wife of the Prophet, which she would emphasize again and again. And the only one she always emphasized who was a virgin when he married her. And insisted on this status, on being different, on standing out. So it's as though it was beneath her to go running after the camel caravan. So she just sat down under a tree, sort of scraggly acacia tree, and waited. And along came this handsome young warrior who had been, you know, off doing other things and was back on his way trying to catch up with the caravan, too. And he was her white knight in shining armor. Behaved with utter, you know, respect and so on, put her on the camel and led her and the camel back the 20 miles to Mecca. But they arrived after nightfall, the whole of Mecca saw her, actually it was Medina, sorry, the whole of Medina saw her being led in by this handsome young warrior whom she'd spent the whole day with alone in the desert, and so, well, you know what happened. Mm-hmm. The rumors started flying, the poets who were the sort of satirists and bloggers and op-ed writers of the time just got busy and so on, writing these absolutely scurrilous verses, leaving Muhammad in a terrible bind as to what to do, you know. So basically it was a challenge to his authority, and you had this young girl, this teenage wife, who suddenly was threatening the whole political authority of Islam as well as its religious authority. And he consulted Ali, who was his first cousin and his son-in-law and the man closest of all to him as to what to do. And Ali's advice, but we only have Aisha's word for this, Ali's advice was actually very odd, considering that he was known for his eloquence and for the depth of his thinking and so on, was basically, to put it quite bluntly, there's plenty of other fish in the sea, divorce her and there'll be others. This was not the kind of thing that Aisha would ever forgive. And I think that was probably the point at which this intense resentment began between her and Ali, made all the stronger by the fact that she never had children, and Ali had two sons, Muhammad's favorite grandsons, Hassan and Hussein. They were the apple of his eye. He's the prophet of Islam. This man who had just, basically, in just 20 years, had begun this enormous religion, this vast revolution in thinking, had done the impossible, as I say, united the tribes of Arabia under one God, poised them to take over the whole of the Middle East, down on his knees, playing horsey with his grandchildren, letting them sort of sit on top of him on his back and kick him with their heels and so on, behaving like any doting grandfather anywhere. And one cannot help but imagine Aisha's resentment of this, at his evident total delight in these grandchildren. And in fact, the split between Shia and Sunni would come to its head not with Ali and Aisha, but one generation later, when one of those grandchildren, Hussein, and nearly all his family, was massacred at Karbala in Iraq. And that would be the event that would be the crystallizing point in the split between Shia and Sunni. That was the event that shocked the whole of the Muslim world at the time and that really defined the two branches of Islam.
Well, there are many murders and assassinations that stem from the death of the Prophet. First, maybe bring us back to that day, the day that Muhammad lay dying. Sketch the scene for us. There he was in his bedchamber. Why was he dying, and what struggle ensued at the point of his death?
He was dying, interesting, in Aisha's chamber. Each of his wives, by then he had 9 wives. Most of these marriages were diplomatic marriages, as was the custom at the time for any major leader. I mean, all you have to do is go through the Hebrew Bible and see how many wives the various kings had. But Muhammad had, in fact, been monogamous with his first wife, Khadija. It was only after she died that he married 9 other wives, one of the first of whom was Aisha, the youngest, and as I say, the favorite. And it was to her chamber he asked to be taken. There was a chambers for each wife were set along the outside wall of the mosque in Medina. And what we're talking about here when we say a chamber is basically a stone lean-to against the wall with a thatched roof, a raised area at the back where the bedding was laid out during the day, during the night, and then folded up during the day, except, of course, now Muhammad was ill. It was an illness that sounds very much like it might have been meningitis, with the terrible, terrible headaches, fever that kept coming and going, an incredible sensitivity to both light and sound. And, of course, he was the leader. He was the man whom everybody wanted to be close to, and everybody, you know, whenever you have a leader of that kind of charisma and that insight, he was the man who had received these amazing revelations, he was called the messenger of God, the one who had brought the word of God to Arabia, and the word of God in their own language, in Arabic, and in the most beautiful Arabic anybody had ever heard, exquisite poetic Arabic. And he was to be the last And it had been said in the Revelations that he was the last who would be the messenger of God. So everybody wanted to be close to him, even as he lay dying. And even as he lay dying, they were crowded into the room arguing about how to treat him, what to give him, what not to give him, shouting at each other to be quiet, as it were. Even when he called at one point for pen and paper, wasn't paper, in fact, it was parchment, but it's called the episode of pen and paper, and there was much debate about this, about what he might have wanted to write. He said that he wanted to write something so that his community would not be led into error after he died. But he never got to write it, because everybody started arguing about it, because they were afraid of what he would say if it was down in writing. If it was made absolutely clear whom he wanted to be his successor, that would mean failure for one side and success for the other. So everybody was afraid of it, and in the end, he just couldn't stand the shouting anymore, and he just said, leave me alone, be quiet, get out. And it's an amazing scene, because you have everybody so involved, everybody wanting the best for Muhammad himself, the best for the community, and yet everybody acting in their own interest, too. It's so human and so vivid. One of the things that astonished me when I was doing the research for it is that when you go back to the earliest sources, to early Islamic historians like Al-Tabari, whose a magnificent volume of early Islamic history comes to 39 volumes in English translation.
And from what date?
From the late 9th century. And what he did, Al-Tabari, He had this most amazing system. He traveled all throughout the Muslim Empire at the time, the Arab Empire at the time, interviewing people, and very, very aware that he was hearing stories that had been passed down through 2, 3, even 4 generations by then. So each time he would write down what they now call the isnad. The isnad is the chain of communication. So somebody would say, I heard this from A, who heard this from B, who heard this from C, who was there when it happened. And then the next person would say, I heard this from D, who heard this from E, who heard this from F, who was there when it happened. So you could have about 12, even 20 different versions of the same conversation or the same battle from different points of view. And each time you could hear the very, very distinct voices of who is speaking. Some of them remember particular details. Others remember first-person dialogue. Others remember sort of a more general thing. But Al-Tabari and all the other early Islamic historians were kind of, you can tell that they're aware that stories change as they get passed from mouth to mouth, and that the best you can do is write them all down, record them all, in the faith that somewhere in the aggregate is as close as you're going to get to, quote-unquote, the truth. It seems to me an extraordinary historical method, one that's really respectful of the Rashomon-like character of memory and perception, and that is really respectful of the way things are handed down and the way they change. So reading him, it's like being in the middle. It's like sitting in the middle of this vast grapevine of gossip at the time, of stories and lore and conversations, of resentments, of envies, of rivalries, and as you say, also, of course, of battle and assassination, but also of loyalty and great heroism.
We're talking with Leslie Hazelton. Her book is After the Prophet. It's about how the Sunni and Shia split in Islam originated. So Muhammad lies dying. There's this, everybody thinks they're doing the best for Islam, but that seems to coincide with what's the best for themselves.
Isn't it always that way?
And Ali ultimately steps back.
He does. Ali is, he's known for his nobility of purpose. And above all, what was important at that time, and still is in Islam, which is perhaps, the most deep and terrible irony of the split between Shia and Sunni, what was most important of all was unity, the idea of unity. In fact, it was so strong that before the Battle of the Camel, in which Aisha led this huge army against Ali and his army, that battle was nearly avoided. Everybody, you could hear everybody arguing against it, against taking up arms, against Muslim killing Muslim. This was everybody's greatest fear, the one thing that they most wanted to avoid, even as there's this kind of awareness that it's perhaps the one thing that cannot be avoided, is in fact inevitable. It's called fitna, which means discord or dissension, but in general means civil war. It always involves terrible chaos and upheaval within the community of Islam. Just the very idea of Muslim killing Muslim was terrifying. And you can hear people saying things like, if we enter this fitna, it will be a rift that can never be repaired. Or another one says, the millstone of Islam is out of balance, and if we go this way, it will never get repaired, and so on. You get people just riding away from the field, just refusing to take part in anything that has to do with shooting a single arrow at another Muslim. And in fact, after 3 days of negotiations, they had agreed to disagree. The two sides had agreed at least not to fight. But as soon as word of that went out, of course, as there always is, there was one small faction who wanted war for their own purposes. And still nobody's quite sure who they were, whether it was a bunch of hotheads, whether it was the people from one side or the other side, whether they were being manipulated from afar or what. But they started fighting. And, of course, the moment they started fighting, and it can only take, what, half a dozen or a dozen people, when you have 10,000 men on each side fully armed, as soon as the noise starts up, the shouting, the clanging of swords, screaming and so on, it was all-out battle. And it was a terrible, terrible battle, which is remembered with extraordinary detail, visceral detail. I mean, literally visceral, viscera spilled out, and legs and arms severed and so on. And the accounts of that battle, they were very often fighting people whom they knew, even fathers against sons, and literally brother against brother. You can feel what it's like, what hand-to-hand combat is like, something we've forgotten nowadays. You can feel the panic to be the one that gets out of there alive, just the desperate use of anything whatsoever, you know, if not a sword, if not a dagger, then an elbow in the kidneys, or a finger in the eye, or a rock from the ground on the head, anything at all, the kind of panic just to stay alive. You can practically hear them panting with desperation. For us in the 21st century, with our remote means of killing, is a very healthy reminder of the terror and the desperation of what actually happens
and
when
real,
one man kills another in war.
Right, and the real cost.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, in your descriptions and in talking about the very human element in the story, and it is a very human story,
mm-hmm.
You're a psychologist as well as a journalist.
Right.
How much did your training as a psychologist inform the writing of this book and your understanding of the characters?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, who I am as a psychologist, it's simply part of me. It's not a conscious use of psychology, but I think there's always that desire. I think any writer has that desire to get inside somebody, to know how they work, to know why, asking why, who was this person, what really happened here. And in that sense, I think every writer is, to some degree, a psychologist. It seems to me essential if you're going to not merely tell the story, but tell it from within, bring the reader right inside it, which is what I really wanted to do here. I wanted to tell the story as it is told in the Middle East so as we can understand why it has such power, why it still inspires people 1,400 years later, perhaps stronger now than ever before, why people have been willing to die for it and, you know, let alone kill others for it. So what I've tried to do here is tell it from the inside, so as we can really grasp the power and the emotive depth of the story, why it is today, not only is it known to all Sunnis throughout the Middle East as history, for the Shia, it is sacred history. It's all but engraved on their hearts. And it seems to me, well, the very fact that we invaded the country that is the cradle of the Shia-Sunni split, Iraq, where in fact most of the story takes place, that we invaded it in 2003 without even having an inkling of the story and of what we were getting into. It's just incredible to me. It is having acted out of such arrogance and such ignorance. And in fact, I'm not sure that arrogance and ignorance do not in the end come down to the same thing.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe just briefly in the few minutes that we have left, bring this home today. Tell us, what was maybe the most important thing that you would like people to take away from this book in understanding the contemporary split of Sunni and Shia?
I think it's very hard in a country which counts its official history in such a short time, just 200 years in the United States, to understand the depth of memory in the oldest culture in the world, which is, in fact, Iraq. What happened 1,400 years ago at Karbala in the year 680 could, for many people, just as well have happened yesterday. It is that alive in people's minds. It's a kind of irony that in the place with the longest and oldest history and memory in the world, Iraq, it's almost as though there is no such thing as the past, because all the past is present. The same applies to the Crusades, which are so alive in Middle Eastern memory. The same applies to the whole of 20th century history of Western intervention in the Middle East. And it's amazing how few of us know this, from the carving up of the not-yet-dead Ottoman Empire in 1916 and the Sykes-Picot Agreement, to American overthrow of a democratically elected premier in Iraq in 1953, Mossadegh, to American shoring up of the Shah, that dictatorship, that regime, to the fact that we were arming both sides in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, so that the 2003 invasion of Iraq is just one step further, and I think probably it's the last straw for any kind of Western authority in the Middle East. We need to respect other cultures, respect their history, respect what makes people tick, what they feel deep in their hearts, instead of saying things like, well, why can't they just all get along? I mean, that happened long ago. Why can't they all just get along? Doesn't work in this country with only 200 years history, let alone in one with such a long history as Iraq.
Well, Leslie Hazelton, your book, After the Prophet, is a marvelous way to really go deeply into this story, to understand the history, the characters, and the very human themes that run very deeply as a thread through it. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Francesca.
Leslie Hazelton. In addition to After the Prophet, she's the author of Mary, a flesh and blood biography of the Virgin Mother, and Jezebel, the untold story of the Bible's harlot queen. Next up, we talk with Tracy Kidder about his book Mountains Beyond Mountains. It's about Haiti, Dr. Paul Farmer, and the organization Farmer founded, Partners in Health. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The heartrending scenes out of Haiti in the wake of the devastating earthquake there are spurring Americans to open their pocketbooks and give to the relief effort. One of the best places to give is to the organization Partners in Health, which has been bringing health services to the poorest people in Haiti for more than 20 years. It does this by training local doctors and medical workers, and by listening to the people it serves to find out what they need and how best to give it. My guest Tracy Kidder's 2003 book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, is about Partners in Health and the remarkable doctor who founded it, Dr. Paul Farmer of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. I rang Tracy Kidder up to talk to him about Paul Farmer, Haiti, and Partners in Health. I started out by asking him what the organization is doing now in response to the earthquake.
Partners in Health has taken a leadership role in, I mean, for instance, they're the ones who've been coordinating and, arranging, I think, the transportation of critically injured patients to the U.S. Navy ship Comfort. They did take a lead role in getting the central hospital back up and running, and they were asked by the World Health Organization to coordinate the, you know, the surgical activities there. They've been managing or you know, getting up and running 24 different operating rooms, which are now going 24 hours a day. And that's thanks to an enormous voluntary effort from a whole lot of the American medical establishment. I mean, I think it includes places like Dartmouth-Hitchcock, Partners Healthcare in Boston, which, of course, is that huge conglomeration of Mass General and the Brigham and the Beth Israel and Children's and so on. The Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, Mount Sinai, University of Pennsylvania Medical School. In any case, they were probably the first responders, or certainly some of the first responders, because Partners in Health, unlike far too many private aid organizations, particularly in Haiti, has striven for years, they've been there for 25 years, to make everything that they do there indigenous. They have 120 doctors, 600 nurses, 2,000 community health workers, roughly, and almost all of them are Haitian. And they're all very well trained. So they were in a position to react very quickly. In addition, you know, they were the largest single health provider in rural Haiti with about 1.3 million patients. But all of their facilities, all their hospitals are, and clinics, there are 12 hospitals and clinics that they run closely with the Ministry of Health, are all out in the countryside, and they were not damaged by the earthquake. So very quickly they were setting up field hospitals in Port-au-Prince, and very quickly they were transporting patients out to their hospitals and receiving them, you know, at their hospitals, and just floods of patients. They've also flown some patients to the Dominican Republic and even to the United States. So it's been an enormous effort. But in addition, you know, they helped set up a surgery center in a town outside Port-au-Prince. It's, last I heard, staffed by University of Miami surgeons. So it's been an enormous effort, and I think they've done, you know, yeoman's work. That's what they usually do, combine idealism and competence in all the countries where they work.
And so often that's not what's rewarded with this kind of responsibility. Talk about why.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So talk about why Partners in Health, you know, did get rewarded this time. Why were they uniquely positioned?
Well, because their hospitals weren't damaged, because they had, they've been there for so long, and because it really is a Haitian operation, which is really unusual. I think that's the answer right there. And also, you know, they have extraordinary people at the top, like Paul Farmer and Ophelia Dahl. Paul Farmer, you know, in addition, is the deputy special envoy to Haiti, a UN job, and he should have an important role in designing the, you know, reconstruction of Haiti, which gives me a considerable hope. The big problem in Haiti, so far as private aid organizations are concerned, is that there are 10,000 of them, or more than 10,000 of them. And, you know, think about that. Think about the money that that represents pouring into Haiti, and think about the results, which is, you know, I mean, Haiti's still one of the poorest countries in the world. So obviously something was wrong. And I think, speaking generally, I think what was wrong was not that all those 10,000 aid organizations were incompetent or weren't well-meaning, but that they weren't working together, and they weren't working with the government, and they weren't, you know, striving to make their projects indigenous. But not working with the government, I think, is one of the biggest issues. The excuse, the usual excuse, that a government is weak or suffers from corruption, it just doesn't hold. I mean, if you fail to work with a government that suffers from corruption, then you simply play into the hands of the parasites who exist in every government everywhere, including governments of ours, you know. But Partners in Health has striven to make the appropriate agencies of the Haitian government, which is constitutionally elected, by the way, full partners in everything they do. One of the big problems with this earthquake is that, in large part because of the history of Haiti and our role in the history of Haiti, the government such as it is there is very, very centralized in Port-au-Prince. And this earthquake absolutely decapitated the government. I mean, just destroyed it. Now, you know, it'll be some time before it can begin to get back on its feet. But the cultivation of better government, more effective government, more competent government, more honest government, that's crucial to the rebuilding of Haiti, it seems to me. And making projects that coordinating the projects of private aid organizations and foreign government involvement, coordinating all of those is really important, and making sure that those projects are Haitianized. That is, you know, it's harder to do it that way. It's not easy to do it. But if you want to come in and start rebuilding, you ought to be hiring Haitians. And you should be training Haitians. in the creation and repair of infrastructure. It just makes sense if you think about it.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think of Afghanistan, for example. There is, you know, the example of, and now I'm blanking on his name, the author.
Mortensen.
Yes, Greg Mortensen, mm-hmm. where he found by enlisting the local population, mm-hmm. they could build things faster and better that were used by the population for mm-hmm. far less money.
Sure. Well, that's the other thing. I mean, Partners in Health, as I said, they have 1.3 million patients, and they do an extraordinary job. This is in what's called the Central Plateau and the Lower Artibonite. They have brought AIDS, tuberculosis, a host of other infectious diseases under control in the Central Plateau. And, you know, this was something that 10 years ago, a lot of experts were saying just wasn't ever going to happen, wasn't possible. And they do this with remarkable economy. And the reason they can do it with remarkable economy is that their people are doing it, are Haitian. And, you know, think of the effects of that. You now have these hundred and some, we're really well-trained Haitian doctors, trained, I think, in the first instance by Paul Farmer and then by each other. You can make a virtuous cycle instead of a vicious one but if you just go in there and do it all in a sort of expatriate mode, in the end, your projects aren't going to last. You aren't going to create the sort of momentum that a country really needs in order to get out of the kind of mire that Haiti is in and has been in for a long time.
Tracy Kidder says a new stage is about to begin in Haitian relief, shifting from rescue to getting the country functioning again.
Most of the critically injured who have not received care are gone. You know, I mean, they're dead.
They're dead.
And it's and I'm sure those numbers are very high. It's a terrible, terrible catastrophe, just a tragedy. But there'll be a new phase coming soon because there are many people still alive and healthy, or, you know, who have received care, but they need shelter, they need food, they need water. Children need to go back to school, you know, whose schools were destroyed. So there's an enormous sort of interim period, I should think, that, you know, looming now, where, you know, you've got to get the country functioning, and while it's functioning, then begin to rebuild.
Right. Yeah, and I wonder if you could also say, you know, I donated to Partners in Health, and I did so really feeling very secure.
Yeah.
In the sense that I felt that probably most of my most of what I donated was going to go to actual
that
care.
Then you actually turn out to be right. Partners in Health spends 6% of donated money on administration, only 6%. That's a really low figure in the world of international aid. Extremely low. So that means 94% of every dollar that's donated goes to direct services for, you know, the purchase of material, the salaries of doctors, you name it. That's the one great thing about Partners in Health. The thing that impressed me so much was that the money gets to the people the donors intended for. And that is not always the case, you know, and I think it's sort of horrifying. It's particularly not the case, has not been the case with a lot of USAID projects. We have these ridiculous policies where we tie our aid. Oxfam had a good article on this not so long ago. What I mean by tying our aid is that we insist that some of it go back to American pockets. So if, for instance, you're trying to do something in, I don't know, Afghanistan or wherever, and you have to fly there, if there are flights on an American-owned airline, you got to go on an American-owned airline, even if they're, you know, and that goes across, sort of across the board. There have been some USAID projects where fully half the money has gone back to, has never really left the Washington Beltway.
Or worse.
I think that's obscene, frankly. And I think a lot of people, my sense is that a lot of people in the State Department and USAID agree and would like to
have it be different.
Reform things, yeah.
I read that Oxfam, or I read about the Oxfam article. I believe, you know, it's even worse than that in a way, because they were talking about how much agricultural aid in Haiti has actually
that's another issue, yeah.
Yeah, has destroyed indigenous rice farming in Haiti.
Well, it's really a crock. That's a sham, because, I mean, after all, this is food that, you know, the U.S. government has bought in order to prop up farm prices here, basically subsidies to our own farmers. So in a way, what we do is we subsidize our farmers at the expense of the Haitian ones. It's once again this business of a very powerful nation harming a small one, and that really ought to stop.
You know, I want to ask you whether this is true. I heard Ted Koppel say that Haiti, you know, when Haiti overthrew the French, they had to pay reparations, which took almost 250 years to pay off. And Koppel said that a lot of the payment was actually in Haiti's hardwood forests.
I don't know that, but I do know about the payment. It didn't happen immediately. These kidnapped West Africans who threw off their French masters, you know, finally the revolution was over in 1804 and the country was a burned ruin, and, you know, it was an unbelievably bloody revolution. But they, you know, they claimed their freedom, they created their own republic about 20 years later, in the 1820s, in any case. That was when France, but see, the whole world shunned Haiti. It was the pariah nation. It's not that the Western powers ever stopped interfering in its affairs, but they refused to give it diplomatic recognition. And in part, in return for diplomatic recognition, Haiti had to pay the French reparations for their slave colony. Now, that's a really strange thing if you think about it. I'm a slave, and now I've got to pay you back because I've gone and gotten myself free. You know, when Aristide made the great mistake, and the former president of Haiti made the great mistake not long before the coup that took him again, the second coup in 2003, I made the statement that France should pay reparations itself for those payments. That evoked tremendous indignation from French diplomats, although
a mistake?
I think it was a pretty good case, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, why is that a mistake?
Well, because at that time he was politically weakened and he was under attack from all sides.
He does play a part in this book. You open it with 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what was going on there. Why were you down there? And I should say before we go on that I'm talking with Tracy Kidder about his book Mountains Beyond Mountains. It's about Paul Farmer, the founder of Partners in Health, whose organization is taking such a lead right now in treating the victims of the Haitian earthquake.
Why was I there? I had gone down for the New Yorker magazine to write a story about American soldiers. I thought it was an interesting use of American military power. This is in 1994 when we had sent, I can't remember the numbers now, but something on the order of 20,000 troops to restore the constitutionally elected government of Haiti, which was headed by the enormously popular former parish priest Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide. He had been overthrown shortly after taking office by a military junta. You know, the saying, I think quite accurate about the Haitian army, was that it never had an enemy except the Haitian people. Anyway, and then for 3 years, this junta ruled Haiti, really. And, you know, this is one episode where the word terror, it seems to me, was correctly used, terrorized the population. And we finally, under Bill Clinton, we sent troops and restored that government. It was a mixed bag, I think, that occupation. But anyway, I went down and I was hanging out with a bunch of Special Forces soldiers. Having been a soldier myself, I have a real soft spot for soldiers. And I was there one night and Paul Farmer showed up to talk to the commander of this little team of soldiers about a murder case.
And so did you know who he was?
Paul, no. Never heard of him before, but we talked cordially and I listened and took notes while he had this conversation with this young captain. And then I ran into him quite by accident on an airplane going back to Miami at Christmas time that year. And he was very generous with his time and began to interpret Haiti for me. Haiti is very confusing to people like me and to the soldiers I was with. It's, you know, for one thing, language. And for another, you know, the kinds of interpreters that usually soldiers usually get aren't necessarily very reliable. In any case, he was wonderfully generous with his time and information, and I saw him again briefly. But I didn't pursue him, even though I learned just the outlines of his life and work. And this is 94, but I didn't pursue him for 6 years after that. I think because Haiti had shocked me, and I think I also sensed that if I started following this guy around, he was going to disturb my peace of mind.
Really?
As he did, in fact. Yeah. Well, you know, I think if you, you know, I have a very privileged life, and I think that one loves to imagine that one has earned all one's privileges. And, you know, that kind of notion falls apart immediately when you go to a place like Haiti and you ask yourself a simple question like, what if I'd been born Haitian? What would my privileges look like then? I don't know. I'm not sure that that's why I didn't pursue him. I went and did something else. But finally, around the turn of the century, right around in late 1999, I met up with him at his hospital in Boston, the Brigham, and he invited me to travel with him for a month.
And he's a pretty... so he invited you to travel with him down to his clinic in Haiti.
Well, we went to Haiti, we went to Russia, we went to Paris, we went to... where else did we go? We went to Cuba. And then I wrote a profile of him for the New Yorker. And then he, after long thought, gave me access to write a book. And so then I went on traveling with him. Traveled with him off and on for about 3 years. Not all over the world, but over a lot of the world.
And he is, he comes across as a very genuine and warm, but also, you know, fierce personality in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about who he is, what he's like.
Well, I think the basic thing about Paul, and by the way, you know, since I stopped scrutinizing him, I mean, I think I've done things in the correct order here. Maybe I should explain myself. I am now a biased journalist, biased towards Partners in Health, but I wasn't at the time. You know, and I approached this subject with all the skepticism I'd acquired over 30 years of writing nonfiction stories. I think that makes it all the better. But now that I'm not scrutinizing him anymore, we're just friends, you know. And I don't idolize him, but I'm really glad that he's on this planet. He is, first and foremost, to me, a doctor. That's what he really loves to do. I mean, this guy can remember lab data from patients 10, 15 years ago. And the way he remembers all this stuff about infectious diseases, it seems to me, is affective. That is, it's his affection for his patients that he remembers the patients, and then he remembers the pathophysiology and the remedies and the, you know, and the cases and so on. And I think that's where his basic strength comes from. I think there's another thing to say about him. You know, he's one of the most sophisticated, smartest people I've ever met. And in other ways, you know, he almost seems innocent in some ways. I mean, although he's not, I don't mean to suggest that he's naive, but to me, he seems like a guy, I mean, he loves herpetology, for instance. He's a gardener, you know, he loves growing things. He strikes me as a person who is in love with the world, absolutely in love with the world, and in direct proportion offended by these horrifying flaws in it, by the terrible injustices that he, you know, first experienced in Haiti. And I think he went to Haiti soon after graduating from Duke, where he went on a full scholarship. And he had a very unusual childhood. And he spent about half of it living in a bus in a campground with his big family, and then on a leaky old 50-foot-long half-homemade boat that was moored in a bayou. And then he went to Duke on a full scholarship, and then he went to Haiti for a year. And I think he'd gone there thinking he was going to be an anthropologist. And I think by the time he got back, he knew he wanted to be a doctor as well, just because of the misery he'd seen there. And you know, as he always does with everything, he began to study the history, and he began to become, you know, quite horrified by what our own country had done there.
We're talking with Tracy Kidder about Dr. Paul Farmer and the organization he founded, Partners in Health, which is taking a lead in the medical relief efforts in Haiti. Farmer and PIH were the subject of Kidder's 2003 book, Mountains Beyond Mountains. So Paul Farmer went to Haiti. He went with fresh eyes. Some of that may have had to do very much with the kind of childhood that he led. What do you feel was the key capacity that he had and the key lesson that he learned in developing this approach? And maybe just briefly tell us, you know, what is really kind of, in a nutshell, the approach of Partners in Health?
I think what they're trying to do is wherever they can, to first and foremost, to relieve suffering and pay attention to individual patients. And I think the technique has been to have individual patients teach them how to treat a family, and a family how to treat a village, and a village how to treat a region, and maybe then how to treat a country. And the two special skills, of course, that Paul and many of his colleagues have brought to this work, but in the early days especially, was both an anthropologist's eye and the clear knowledge that you had to speak, not just speak the language, but understand it, really understand it, so you knew connotations, and also, you know, skilled in medicine. And those two can be a pretty potent combination. Now, just to give you a quick example, it's very easy. I mean, you could read a lot of scholarly papers that say that belief in sorcery, for instance, in some countries is a real impediment to bringing modern medicine to them. But in fact, not if you're an anthropologist. Paul I had dozens of voodoo priests who were his patients, and they worked like for a while as virtual community health workers for him. Because if you're an anthropologist, you understand that culture is not a fixed thing, and that if you introduce a cure into a culture, you give some people some pills on a regular basis, and they start not dying from symptoms that were killing everybody. You know, we're always killing everybody before. People are going to look around and say, maybe I'd like those pills. But that doesn't mean they're going to stop believing in sorcery. And, in fact, there's a wonderful story in my book to that effect. So, you know, you don't want to go and make enemies of the local, you know, local voodoo priest if that's, you know, in a place like Haiti. You don't have to.
Mm-hmm. And you're really talking about a very profound respect for the people that he's working with.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also an effective one. Yeah, I mean, I think there is a line here. That doesn't mean that you think herbalism is more effective than antibiotics when you know damn well it isn't. But it does mean that, yeah, you want to be respectful, of course. I mean, why else would you be going down there to help these people?
One would think that, right?
Yeah, well, people have a lot of motives for this kind of work. Yeah. And some of them are really, truly beside the point. Even ones that, you know, at first blush look like they're good reasons. You know, there is at least one national pundit who the other day was saying that, you know, Haiti's extreme vulnerability to earthquakes and so on is just as a result of its desperate poverty, long-standing poverty. But this one national pundit wrote a column wanting to make you think that, you know, Haitian culture was to blame for Haiti's poverty. Well, don't you believe it? That's just utter nonsense.
Well, say more about that. Haiti's poverty, you mean because of the buildings? Why does Haiti's poverty make it more vulnerable to a pretty huge earthquake?
Well, isn't that obvious? I mean, you don't use reinforced concrete. You don't use, you know, good building materials because you don't have the money to supply them. A poor country also lacks, you know, expertise. It lacks basic good engineering, you know. That's why you have extreme vulnerability. Those buildings weren't built with earthquakes in mind, as they would be in San Francisco now or Los Angeles. Haiti is deforested, large parts of it, because of poverty, ultimately. And that has made it so vulnerable to floods that, I mean, it doesn't even take a hurricane anymore. A good tropical storm will kill thousands in floods.
And you feel some hope now?
Yes, I do. For one thing, Haitians are optimistic people, and they're tough. And I don't ever want to be in a position of declaring despair on their behalf, you know. But I also feel some hope because I do think that Partners in Health is, you know, it's big in Haiti, and it's offered the world a real model for how you might, to rebuild Haiti better, as Bill Clinton has put it. You really might be able to do it this time. I mean, people have been saying, oh, this will be a new day for Haiti for quite a while. But it does seem to me that that having PIH in what I hope will be a leadership role really might finally, you know, give the world a model for doing this. And, you know, and the fact that Paul Farmer should have a hand in designing the reconstruction, will have a hand almost certainly, that also gives me a lot of hope.
Tracy Kidder, talking about Haiti and his book Mountains Beyond Mountains, published in 2003. It's about Paul Farmer and Partners in Health. If you want to donate to Partners in Health and their efforts in Haiti, go to www.pih.org. You can also go to writersvoice.net for a link, as well as the links to other information about the book. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. You can listen to all our shows, plus find out much more about our guests and their books at writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.